news, notes, and Zola next on Baseball HQ Radio.
Learn to play the winner's way, because Baseball HQ Radio starts right now. And here's your host from BaseballHQ.com, columnist Patrick Davitt.
And welcome to Baseball HQ Radio for Friday, May the 15th. It's show number 26 of the 2015 fantasy baseball season. I'm Patrick Davitt, your host, and we have another great show for you. We'll talk with Todd Zola, our regular Friday Talk with Todd commentator, about handedness issues in daily games, about batters who are striking out more than in past years, about what Michael Pineda and Corey Kluber's huge strikeout games mean, and more. We'll also have our regular contributors from BaseballHQ.com, the best fantasy baseball website in the business. We'll have player news from the National League with Harold Nichols, looking at Nolan Arenado, the Diamondbacks' closer situation, and more. And from the American League with Jock Thompson, looking at a shakeup in the White Sox infield, the Red Sox rotation, and more. In our regular matchups analysis, Greg Fishwick looks at risk-reward situations. And in Master Notes, BaseballHQ.com co-general manager and speculator columnist Ray Murphy talks about catching casualties. It's another big show. Thanks for joining us here at Baseball HQ Radio. Hey, what do you say? Todd Zola is in the house and he's ready to go. We gotta talk some baseball. And in the first inning of this Friday News and Notes edition, our League Watch News reports. Jock Thompson is on deck with players from the American League, and leading off, it's the National League report and our old friend Harold Nichols. Nick, welcome back to Baseball HQ Radio.
Thank you, Patrick. Always good to be here.
We talked earlier this year about Colorado third baseman Nolan Arenado. His skills have been outstanding, and his results are catching up. He's got 6 home runs this year, 17 RBI, and he's almost at 300. I think he's hitting 294, 295, something like that. It's starting to look like Nolan Arenado is a rising potential superstar, but I know Steven Nickrand has written recently about Arenado and others in his value players for the future and the buyer's guides, both pitching and hitting. Is Nolan Arenado for real?
Yeah, Nolan Arenado sure looks like he's for real. And what you got to remember at this point is Nolan Arenado is 24 years old. So if you're in a keeper league, this is a guy certainly to target. Steven's column, the columns this week on young building blocks, I think are especially important for keeper leagues because they're targeting young guys below the age of 26 who are really starting to put things together. And Arenado at this point actually may not be giving the kind of production that we would actually expect. 6 home runs, 17 RBIs, 292 BA, that's just okay. But his XBA is 321, power index of 154. I mean, these are all indications at a 90% contact rate. I mean, that's huge. So all indications that he could go up from where he is, which would, here's a guy that could be certainly in the top tier of third baseman in baseball within the next year or two, if not the top third baseman in baseball. So a good guy to target, I think, in a keeper league.
Keeper dynasty formats for sure reward having players like Nolan Arenado, especially coming into his own at a relatively young age. We have Baseball HQ research that suggests it's not really an age thing, it's an experience thing, and you're looking for players with certain plate appearance thresholds rather than crossing over certain ages. And that the reason we think of it as age is that most players cross the PA thresholds at those certain ages, 25, 26, 27. Nolan Arenado got started young, and so he hit the PA threshold a little earlier. And boy, that 90% contact rate is certainly a very strong recommendation.
It really is. I mean, there are very few guys with a contact rate like that, and especially with that kind of power.
Yeah, we usually think of power guys as swing and miss guys, and the fact is Nolan Arenado's putting the bat on the ball, and as we've said on the show many times, avoiding striking out is just a generally good thing for fantasy players because even your outs have the potential to do something useful.
Right, very definitely.
We're projecting Nolan Arenado's power pace to slow down with 18 home runs the rest of the way and just 61 more RBIs, a bit of a factor there having to do with his team. Nick, in San Diego, catcher Derek Norris was a preseason sleeper on many lists, but he's boosted his batting average to nearly 300 and yet his power seems to be lagging behind what we expected. What's the analysis on Derek Norris?
Yeah, Derek Norris is certainly, I think, right on the cusp of a real breakout. I mean, Derek Norris is, we know that catchers come into their own a little bit. It takes them a while to develop the offense and especially to develop the power. Frequently don't peak until their early 30s. And certainly that has a lot to do with what they have to do behind the plate and their concentration on the defensive part of the ball. And Derek Norris put up good enough numbers last year that he was an interesting gamble coming into the season. And he's putting up really, really nice numbers to start this season. I mean, the power hasn't really been there, but a PX of 143 suggests that the home runs are going to come. He's hitting .304, which is certainly... you'll certainly take that from a catcher any time. We had said in the forecaster an up possibility of 280, 25, 100 for Derek Norris. He may not get quite there this year, but that's something certainly to look at down the road for Derek Norris. This is the kind of guy who can do that sort of damage out of the catcher position. So a good guy to target, and at this point may still be available in some leagues, and you may be able to get him in a trade from someone who's not expecting that kind of eventual development.
Yeah, that's right. They may think Derek Norris is peaking now and that where the good year that he's having is about as good as it gets. You're going to be buying high to a certain extent, but you may also be buying low when you look farther down the road. Now, we should say that right now, BaseballHQ.com's projections for Derek Norris are not entirely so optimistic. We think he's going to sneak into double digits in home runs, 10, 11, something like that, and peak out in the high 50s, low 60s in RBIs. It's a tough park to hit in San Diego, and this is important. The projection says he's going to provide a hit to your batting average with just a .252 for the rest of this season, finishing up the year in the mid 260s. So be aware of that. Even as we are optimistic about his long-term future, there may be some growing pains yet to come, especially playing in a tough park. In the Playing Time Today column, Nick, analyst Rob Carroll looked at reports that Addison Reed might be in trouble in Arizona and could even lose the closer role. Nick, what's the situation with Addison Reed? And more importantly, if he is replaced, who's next in line to be the replacement?
Well, Addison Reed is certainly struggling at this point. He's only 2-for-4 in save chances so far this year. He's allowed runs in 4 of his last 6 outings, 8 runs allowed and 7 innings pitched during that time. His ERA is up to 7.20 after giving up 4 runs in a Wednesday appearance this week. A whip of 1.90. I mean, it really is bad with Addison Reed. So there's certainly a possibility that Brad Ziegler could replace him. Ziegler has some save experience, 1.26 ERA so far this year. And so just one run allowed in 15 setup outings. So Brad Ziegler looks like a possibility in Arizona. But the thing to remember about Brad Ziegler is that he's not all that great a pitcher either. He tends to walk a lot of guys, and that's the problem he's going to have. Is his walk rate is going to be a lot higher and his command ratio a lot lower than we would like to see it. So while Brad Ziegler certainly may replace Addison Reed, I'm not sure he's someone you want to go out and target. The other thing to remember is that at the moment, Arizona does not have a huge number of save chances. I think they are tied. I saw something that said they were tied with, the White Sox for the fewest save chances in the majors so far this year. And so, even if Brad Ziegler gets a chance to put up some saves, he may not have that many opportunities to do so.
Brad Ziegler's had a career history of not being a real dominant pitcher. 7.3 strikeouts per 9. His dominance rate in 2014 was by far a career high. He's been pretty good on the command side, 2.0, 2.3, but as you mentioned, this year's well down in that particular category as well. So he's walking a few too many guys, striking out too few guys. And it's an interesting point you made about Arizona and the number of save opportunities. There's always a debate going on, and has been for years, about whether you're better off getting a closer from a poor team on the assumption that what wins they get will be close wins, or on a good team on the assumption that they'll get more wins and therefore more save chances. I actually did research for BaseballHQ.com a little while ago, And the research definitely points to the get a closer on a good team theory, because the amount of saves is roughly always 50% of the amount of wins. There's no evidence to suggest that poor teams have more close wins, therefore more close save opportunities. Brad Ziegler, as you said, Nick, I don't think that even if he gets the role, he's going to give you a tremendous amount of saves.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, and who knows if he will hold, given that, and given his penchant for walking guys, who knows if he would hold the role for any length of time.
It's going to be a fluid situation until they find somebody somewhere who can take on the role. And it's often a situation when you're talking about closers that somebody catches the manager's eye, has a few good outings, and locks into the role. There's lots of guys over the years who have done exactly that and ended up being long-term closers. But I don't think that's going to be the situation with Brad Ziegler. Finally, Nick, the Cubs right-handed starter Kyle Hendricks had a terrific season last year, a 2.45 ERA, 1.08 WHIP. These are really good fantasy numbers. This year, not so much. In fact, he's being dropped in some leagues because he's got a ERA closer to 5 and a WHIP around 130. Very disappointing results. Nick, is this a case of the statistical chickens coming home to roost?
Somewhat. It's one of those kind of strange things that happens. My guess is what happened is a lot of guys paid for that 2.46 ERA in their drafts, and now seeing something close to 5, they're deciding that was a fluke and they're bailing out. And, you know, if we've taken a good look at where things were last year, Baseball HQ kind of warned that sub-3 ERA was not what it should have been. A 3.77x ERA seemed more realistic. And this year, things have, as you said, the statistical chickens have come home to roost and things have flipped. And we're now looking at an ERA close to 5, but again, a 3.85x ERA. So this is pretty much the same picture we were looking at a year ago. The key here is that Kyle Hendricks is a guy worth looking at. I mean, here's a guy with an overall BPV as a starter of 84. That's not quite the top echelon of starters, but that's not bad at all. Probably the thing that you worry about a little bit with Kyle Hendricks is he doesn't throw very hard, a velocity just below 90. And so his dominance is not as much as you would like. But here's a guy who keeps the ball on the ground, gets a decent number of strikeouts, and could be a decent starter once those current numbers turn around, which, of course, they're likely to.
Not as good as last year, not as bad as this year, I think, is what you're telling us, and perhaps a buy-low opportunity as long as you're not expecting too much.
Right, I think so. I mean, yeah, keep the expectations realistic on Kyle Hendricks, and if you know what you think you're getting, then he's certainly someone worth rostering.
I know on my own mixed league team in Tout Wars, a guy like Kyle Hendricks is probably at least a little better than some of the last desperate picks I have in the starting pitcher lineup on my team, because he's one of those pitchers who just seems to go out there and pitch an average sort of way most of the time. And I think there's some room for improvement this year if you're looking for short-term gains.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, just a general comment. We're at a point in the season when a lot of managers start to bail on guys that they expected to do exceptionally well, and suddenly they've discovered that they're not doing as well as they thought. But remember, we're really just getting into the season. We haven't hit the warm weather yet. A lot of things are going to change over the course of the next month.
Well said, Nick. Thanks very much for talking with us, and we'll catch up with you again in a week's time.
Thank you, Patrick.
Harold Nichols writes pitcher matchups for BaseballHQ.com and covers players in the National League here on Baseball HQ Radio. Now let's shift to the American League and BaseballHQ.com Director of News and Analysis, Jock Thompson. Jock, what's going on?
Not much, PD. Trying to dodge some raindrops out here, which is a little surprising in mid-May in Southern California, but good for us, huh?
Yeah, you guys are really suffering the effects of that drought. I hope the rain continues, but chances are it probably won't. Maybe there'll be some rainouts in L.A. and San Diego.
Yeah, well, we're kind of lucky right now, at least as far as we're concerned. Obviously, we're Angel season ticket holders, but the Angels just left town before all this started, so we're not missing anything right now.
Well, let's start in the Midwest, where they've had weather trouble of their own, especially regarding baseball. In Chicago, the White Sox infield has had a big change. Micah Johnson, who started the year at second base, has been demoted to the minors, and this seems like a bit of a surprise, given he was hitting 270, had 3 stolen bases, seemed to be doing pretty well. But but I guess there were some issues in the field. Mike Shears covered all this in Playing Time today for BaseballHQ.com. What's going on in Chicago with that second base situation?
I hadn't paid much attention to Johnson before I went out to Chicago this last week, but I got an earful from the fans out there about how bad his defense was, among others. And his offensive metrics, actually, now that I look at them, that he has a real empty .270 batting average. That wasn't going to last based on a 35% hit rate, a .240 expected batting average, and a 52% hard contact rate. As Mike points out, only two of his 20 hits to date were extra base hits. But you're right, what got him demoted was the fact that he's been rated as one of the worst defensive second basemen in baseball, and he was making also some atrocious base running gaffes. Chicago had some high expectations entering 2015, and they've been one of the worst defensive teams in baseball, so given Johnson's remaining options, this was an easy call for the White Sox to make.
Yeah, I knew about the defensive lapses, but I haven't seen many White Sox games this year, so I wasn't aware of base running. But you'd think a marginal player like Micah Johnson, as he now stands, he may turn out to be a terrific player sometime down the road. But in his current status, you'd think, boy, the two things that he has a lot of control over are his defensive abilities and especially base running. I mean, that's just concentration, usually.
Yeah, he only had five base running attempts. I mean, like I said, it's early and it's cold in Chicago in the spring. He was successful on three of them, but the base running that I'd heard about is basically just making stupid decisions.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing you can't afford if you're the White Sox and you have aspirations. You can't run yourself into outs. So the obvious question, Jock, is who's going to get the playing time at second base for the White Sox?
Well, one reason this was such an easy call is that Carlos Sanchez at AAA is a plus defender, and he was hitting .344 when he was called up. He was promoted to take Micah Johnson's spot, as had actually been predicted earlier in our watch list last week by Alex Stopp. Sanchez had 100 at-bats with the White Sox last season, so it's not like he's inexperienced. The problem for fantasy owners is that Sanchez has even less power than Johnson, and despite his decent speed, he's not a great base runner. His big season to date in AAA had been the result of some hit rate luck, so he's not a terrific fantasy grab unless this continues. This move is primarily defensive. They hope that Sanchez can contribute something, but he only hit .250 in his 100 at-bats last year with the White Sox, with no homers and just one stolen base, so it's obviously not great production.
On the other hand, just getting somebody who can field the position and not run into easy base running outs might be a benefit for the White Sox that they're willing to take for the time being. But is there anybody else here who might be able to benefit for fantasy purposes because the White Sox may have other options?
Yeah, you want to keep an eye on utility Emilio Bonifacio. Hasn't played much at all in the early going after signing as a free agent. I think everybody knows he's a versatile switch hitter who can handle the outfield and several infield positions defensively. He really doesn't offer much offensively, but he does offer a running game. Not yet. He's only had 32 at-bats, and again, the springs are cold. He doesn't even have a stolen base attempt yet. But obviously, this is going to change as the weather warms up and he gets opportunities. He has plus speed, and he has averaged over 30 stolen bases over the past four seasons. So he's a guy that could get some playing time and actually help fantasy owners, at least marginally, from a running game standpoint.
Yeah, from your lips to God's ear, Bonifacio is the one player I have on both my fantasy teams, and I was really expecting more than this, and I was kind of surprised, Jock, that they didn't give him more of a chance to play in the infield in the early going instead with Micah Johnson and now calling up Carlos Sanchez. How likely is it that eventually Bonifacio gets some significant playing time at the Keystone?
That's a really good question. It's clear that the White Sox believe that even though they had high expectations, they're in rebuilding mode. They want to try to develop some of these young players. Carlos Sanchez, I think, is going to have to produce a little bit and not play defense because I don't think Chicago wants to see their season go downhill, particularly as the weather warms up. If fans keep staying away, that doesn't help them. So a lot depends on Sanchez and Johnson, but if Bonifacio gets in there and starts producing, he could build some playing time really quickly.
For the time being at BaseballHQ.com, we have depth charts for all the teams, and the Carlos Sanchez looks like he's going to get 70% of the playing time that's left in the season for the White Sox at second base, with Bonifacio stepping up to about 15%. But of course, that's a situation, as you say, Jock, that's going to remain in flux. The Tigers lost starting catcher Alex Avila maybe as long as 6 weeks with some knee issues, and he may still have surgery, which would make it even longer. For the time being, it looks like James McCann is going to be the replacement. So how does McCann stack up as a fantasy player, and who will back him up? Is there any hope beyond James McCann?
Well, this is an interesting situation because Avila's been the Tigers' starting catcher for a long time now. The problem is that he can't stay healthy. He's had concussion issues for the past couple of years. And the other problem is his batting average. It's trailed off now three straight seasons. He doesn't make great contact. It's sub 70%. He's got very, very good power. And the interesting thing about this situation is McCann is a better defensive catcher than Avila, and he hits for contact, which when you think about Detroit, they've got all the power they need. If you can sub in a catcher who is going to stay healthy, is going to hit for 80% contact, maybe provide you a better batting average, and perhaps handle pitchers better and play better defense, Mike Shears, who wrote about this in one of his columns, made the comment that Avila could find himself as the second string catcher when he comes back, and I think he might be right.
Yeah, I was looking at James McCann's skill set, and the big problem I think here is he doesn't walk. He's down around 2% right now, typically more like 3 or 4. That's what we're projecting. But that means his on-base percentage is well under 300. You hit the nail on the head, I think, Jock, when you said the last thing Detroit needs to worry about is power, but they sure wouldn't mind if they had a decent defensive catcher who could reach base once in a while to be driven around by all those big thumpers in the middle of their order.
Yeah, exactly. And as far as Holiday goes, I don't think McCann has much to worry about with regard to him. Holiday has a .243 batting average and 110 major league at bats career-wise. His career minor league batting average is .243. He hit .231 last year in the majors. He's just not a terrific hitter, and McCann is a better defender. So I think McCann is going to be the guy for the time being, and let's see what happens when Avila gets back.
But in either case, it doesn't sound like we're seeing the second coming of Mike Piazza here either. Matt Dodge at BaseballHQ.com covered the story of Boston putting Justin Masterson on the DL with what they called shoulder fatigue, which is a new one on me, and the announcement that Stephen Wright is going to take Masterson's rotation spot for at least the next start, and maybe the one after. How should Stephen Wright figure in the plans of fantasy owners?
Well, Wright is a 30-year-old knuckleballer. He's pitched decently in AAA and even in the majors. I think he has a 3.80 ERA, limited time, but he doesn't really look like a permanent solution to anything. I think Boston's hoping he's going to eat some innings, but I wouldn't count on him as a long-term fantasy option.
I wouldn't either for all the reasons you suggest. So is Baseball HQ or you personally looking at a more permanent change or a trade or something the Red Sox might do to shore up their rotation, which is really the weak link of an otherwise pretty competitive team?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I don't think they're going to do anything permanently, at least now. A couple of things are going on here. As I mentioned, the Red Sox rotation has been more disastrous than expected. Although, interestingly enough, the most recent starts from Wade Miley and Joe Kelly have been some of their best efforts that they've made all season. But the Red Sox have changed pitching coaches, and now from all reports, they want to give the current rotation a little more rope, and they want to give new pitching coach Carl Willis a chance to improve on some things and maybe offer his own analysis. In the meantime, they've got some interesting names in AAA, and if Masterson can improve when he gets back from the DL on what is right now a 6.37 ERA and about 5 walks per 9 innings, he's going to be the first to go.
You mentioned some AAA candidates for the rotation. Who are you looking at?
Well, the name I like the most, who has the most upside, is 22-year-old left-hander Eduardo Rodriguez, who came over from Baltimore last year in return for Andrew Miller back when the Orioles were making their divisional drive and the Red Sox were out of it. Rodriguez has been great since coming over, first at AA last year and now at AAA, where right now he has a 2.86 ERA and a 34-5 strikeout-to-walk ratio over his first 35 innings. He has number 2, number 3 starter upside per most scouts, And of all the most interesting rotation prospects, he's the name I'd bet that we see first, at least right now, based on his current performance and the fact that he's already on the 40-man roster.
Well, now, Jock, what about Henry Owens? I remember back at the start of the season, even in the spring training period, his name was all over the place as someone who might even make the rotation out of spring training. He didn't, of course, but why wouldn't Henry Owens be the first name?
Yeah, Owens was a tick ahead of Rodriguez on most preseason prospect lists, and he too is at AAA Pawtucket. But he struggled early in the season, particularly with his walks. He's given 25 free passes in 31 innings. And given that he's not on the 40-man roster right now, I would think Boston would give him a little more time to work out his issues. The biggest competition that Rodriguez seems to have for the first call-up comes from Brian Johnson, who doesn't quite have the upside or pure stuff of either Rodriguez or Owens. But he's a pitchability guy who's performed at every level, and despite an elevated walk rate in the early going, he's got a 2.72 ERA in his first 36 innings at Pawtucket. Now, he's not on the 40-man roster, but the fact that he's a couple years older than Rodriguez may actually work in his favor in terms of him getting a call.
And also, Brian Johnson, 39 strikeouts, I think, in his first 36 innings, which is going to catch anybody's attention. Staying on the subject of pitchers, some devastating news for the Tampa Bay Rays, another huge rotation loss. They already had Alex Cobb done with Tommy John surgery. Now Drew Smyly probably out for the season with a torn labrum. Matt Dodge of BaseballHQ.com has covered this story. He says the Rays were already treading water. Is there any interesting names at all out there that could possibly help the Rays or fantasy owners?
You know, they've got a bunch of fringe guys that have piqued some fantasy owners' interest occasionally. Alex Colomé alternates decent starts with iffy starts. He's a guy you can at least watch. Erasmo Ramirez, obviously, a couple of years ago, everybody was on him, but recently he's had trouble with gopheritis in the walk. He actually had a pretty good five-inning start the other night against the Yankees. He held the Yankees to a single run, so he's somebody you can watch. Matt Andreese is another. Tampa Bay right now is hoping that Matt Moore, remember him? He was once considered the best pitching prospect in baseball. They're hoping that Moore will be ready for a rehab assignment soon and join the rotation shortly thereafter. He used to be a horse. He had all kinds of upside. Then he went through Tommy John surgery. He actually had a couple of years where he seemed to be breaking down. But if he can reclaim anything close to the peak form he displayed several years ago as a rookie, he's certainly worth rostering.
I remember Erasmo Ramirez being the darling of a lot of people's eyes when he was pitching in Seattle. So far this year, one good thing about him, a 56% ground ball rate, which is pretty impressive, but it's a small sample size of just 24 major league innings so far this year. Has Tampa got anything on the farm that might look like help?
Well, they've called up Andrew Bilotti, who has been getting some kudos from observers and scouts early this season watching the Rays, as someone who's elevated his game. And his first appearance was a pretty good 3 1/3 scoreless relief effort. So he's a possibility. I should mention at AAA, he had a 2.11 ERA over 22 innings and four starts with a 20-5 strikeout to walk ratio. So that's interesting. Further down in the minors, you have Blake Snell, who seems to be coming on fairly strongly right now. He's got 40 scoreless innings to begin the season with a 48-16 strikeout to walk ratio over those 40 innings. Unfortunately, while it's impressive, it's his first double-A experience, and it's difficult to believe right now that the rebuilding Rays are going to rush him.
No, but it looks like it's at least Blake Snell, a name to put on the back of your mind or on your reserve list if your format allows it. 40 scoreless innings at a reasonably decent level of competition is always pretty impressive, as you mentioned. Still more pitching, still more injuries in Oakland. Jock, you wrote a couple of interesting notes covering the A's in your Playing Time Tomorrow space. Following the setbacks that occurred with Jared Parker and AJ Griffin, they were both expected back pretty soon. Doesn't look like they're going to be back as soon as hoped. What's going on with the A's rotation?
Well, Jared Parker's going to be out for the year. He has a fractured elbow. The A's are still expecting AJ Griffin to return, but they were expecting him in June. Now it looks more like July. He's going to be delayed by a month. The interesting thing here now, as I noted, is that Jesse Chavez's life seems to have been extended a little bit, and Chavez is pitching pretty good. He's got a 2.56 ERA, 3.54 expected ERA, through his first 32 innings, including a 9.1 strikeout per nine innings rate, very good control, and three pure quality start doms in his first four starts. He's allowed just one home run for the season. That's been the key to his early success, and that's probably going to rise because he's not a strong ground ball pitcher. But if you remember what Chavez did last year until he faded a little in the second half, I'd be holding him right now. I'm going to be interesting to see what happens to Chavez.
Yeah, it could be interesting. His projection at baseballhq.com is looking for six wins, about a $6 5x5 player with 100 strikeouts or so. The ERA and WHIP are going to be a little high, even for like a fourth starter. Certainly in a mixed league, he's going to be very questionable. A little more rosterable, I think, in an American League league, but he's getting close to four ERA and a 1.25 ratio. Nowadays, that's not exactly great.
No, it's not. And we're talking about a bottom of the rotation guy, and usually in most deep leagues, if you're in a shallow league, he's probably going to be a very marginal guy and maybe even unrosterable.
And you seem to think in the piece that Jesse Chavez's shelf life as a starting pitcher could go on a little bit longer, not only for the because of the injuries, but for other reasons. Can you explain?
Yeah, this is why we try to look down the road and try to project what's going to happen over the next few months. You've got a rebuilding Oakland team. They're already last in the AL West. Their priciest starting pitcher right now, and one of their best, Scott Kazmir, is going to be a free agent to be in 2016. There's no doubt in my mind that Oakland is going to make him available on the trade block, which is going to take it's going to open up a rotation spot. So even if AJ Griffin returns, Chavez is looking pretty good here. It wouldn't surprise me to see him continue in the rotation for the entire year as long as he keeps pitching well.
And of course, if Oakland stays down at the bottom of the standings, you have to believe Scott Kazmir's days are numbered by the Bay. He's a free agent coming up, pretty expensive salary for the Oakland A's, who are fairly close to the chest with their nickels and dimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Kazmir's making $10, $11 million a year. The sooner they get him off the payroll, the better.
All right, Jock, good information. Thanks. Really appreciate it, and we'll catch up with you again next Friday.
Sounds good, PD.
Hope it keeps raining for you. Jock Thompson is the Director of News and Analysis at BaseballHQ. And of course, he covers the American League players here at Baseball HQ Radio. When we come back, it's our regular weekly Talk with Todd. It's Todd Zola coming up next on Baseball HQ Radio.
I was asking you, sir, why it is that baseball wants this bill passed.
I would say I wouldn't know, but I would say the reason why they'd want it passed is to keep baseball going as the highest baseball sport that has gone into baseball, and from the baseball angle. I'm not going to speak of any other sport. I'm not in here to argue about other sports. I'm in the baseball business. It's been run cleaner than any baseball business that was ever put out in the 100 years at the present time.
Well, Mr. Mantle, do you have any observations with reference to the applicability of the antitrust laws to baseball?
My views are just about the same as Casey's.
Baseball HQ Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Baseball HQ Radio. I'm Patrick Davitt. Baseball HQ is working 24/7 to give you everything you need to succeed, like these features. The Doug Dennis's Bullpen Buyer's Guide column looks at relievers who are clicking on all cylinders so far. Our Playing Time Today news analysis looks at whether Addison Reed is still the closer in Arizona, talked about that earlier with Harold Nichols, as well as DL stints for Drew Smyly, John Segura, and a bunch of others, as well as many other stories. And in our Facts and Flukes performance analysis, Greg Pyron validates the work of Jake Arrieta, Todd Frazier, Lance Lynn, and many more. BaseballHQ.com updates content every day across a wide range of great information and tools like our Buyer's Guide Skills Assessment columns, performance validation in Facts and Flukes, roster changes in Playing Time Today and Tomorrow, daily matchups, team coverage, minor league scouting, as well as our projections and the other roster management tools you can use to help dominate your league. And it's only at the website with Fantasy Baseball Intelligence for Winners, BaseballHQ.com. Now it's time for our regular weekly Talk with Todd, and it's a pleasure to once again be joined by Todd Zola, contributor to BaseballHQ.com, Chandler Park, ESPN, Fantasy Alarm, Masters Ball, and others. Todd Zola, welcome back to Baseball HQ Radio.
Great to be back, Patrick.
You recently had a research piece at Fantasy Alarm looking at data relating to handedness as it relates to daily play. Now, we talked last week about people misinterpreting the importance of batter versus pitcher. Are we also overstating or understating the importance of handedness insofar as picking players for our daily games?
No, well yes, there is a critical mistake people are using with handedness. We can get to that in just a second. The idea, just like last week, the idea of the study is to show what I use in my projection system to alter my neutral projection for the day. And I think, I think everybody knows that, lefties and lefties and righties don't hit as well as the opposite head in this matchups. So I needed to know exactly what the difference is. So I ran some studies to figure out exactly what the difference is, and I incorporate that into my projection system. But along the way, the numbers, it's fun just to stop and take a look at the different numbers themselves. That's what the crux of the study was, to determine by what percent do I need to adjust the neutral projection for a lefty-righty and a righty-lefty matchup, et cetera, that night for that player.
And what did you find when you looked into it?
Sometimes what you intuit is actually what comes out, and the lefty-lefty matchup is best for the pitcher. The righty-righty is second best. And actually something that was a little bit weird was previously the best matchup was left-handed hitters against right-handed pitchers, but that flipped in 2014. And, for my projection model, I really don't care. But from a baseball fan, it's interesting. It may have to do with shifts being put on left-handed hitters. It just may have to do with the quality of pitching that's coming up, which hand it is, and the quality of hitting that's coming up, which hand it is. I mean, the difference is slight. I think that you can consider lefty-righty and righty-lefty matchups to be about equal as far as, how the statistically how different they are. But I just did find it different than in 2014. If did them out by a graph that the last two bar columns flipped as far as which was higher, which was lower.
You talked about what we think about intuitively about this, and I've always figured, seeing the stats, that there was a slight advantage for the left-handed hitters across the right-handed pitchers was because there's so many more right-handed pitchers for those left-handed hitters to see that they might benefit from just repetition against that kind of situation. Whereas the right-handed hitter who has a theoretical advantage against the left-handed pitcher doesn't see as many of them to work on it or practice or benefit from it.
Through 2013, that was the case. But for some reason, last year, the numbers flipped. Now, that's why I said the shift. You're going to get more shifts
right
on left-handed batters than you are right-handed batters. And since they're so close to begin with, that maybe was just enough to flip it around to give the advantage to the right-handed batter. Now, if you're picking out individual players for, say, a daily game or your daily roster moves, if you have a left-handed batter and he's not shifted, he still could incur a greater advantage. It might just be that there's a handful of lefties that are pulling the average down.
And maybe that will turn around when they start realizing that all they have to do is just kind of poke it down towards third base and get a bunch of hits, and that'll take the shifting pressure off at least a little bit. I've noticed that some left-handed power hitters are starting to do that, surrendering the chance for a home run just to get on base, and getting on base has its own reward.
Right, and I think eventually what they're hoping is teams don't shift against the player anymore, so right, they're able to go back to what they're doing best and just, letting loose and hitting for power. It's not so much, that they want to get those little dinky dunky singles. David Ortiz would much rather do that slow home run trot than have to, run really hard base to base. But, on occasion, to get them out of that shift, you want to hit. On the other hand, if I'm a defensive team, depending on the situation, I'd much rather have the guy try to get that little bitty hit because he's not going to do it every time.
Right.
And, take him out of their game. But, as far as the actual studies and the use utility of it goes, you know, people might be wondering, you know, why use the global? Don't people have their own splits that we should be using to figure out how they're going to do? And that's sort of what you referenced at the beginning is there a mistake? Is there something that's misused with this data? And that's exactly what it is a player, you know, we see their splits and we hear announcers talk about their splits, but somewhat surprisingly, a player doesn't own his splits until he's in the league about 5 years. And then you can say that this player, you know, is significantly better against righties or lefties or has reverse splits or something to that nature. Until a player is in the league for five solid years, 3,000 plate appearances, you have to assume that his splits are going to at least regress towards the league splits. And I think that's the mistake people make, especially for young players, is they see a guy come up and show a certain characteristic, you know, halfway through his rookie season and assume that he's going to defeat the global nature of what a split is. And it's not necessarily the case. You see, I have to go against the grain and regress those numbers towards what everybody else does.
And it seems to me, Todd, that there would be a kind of an error bar issue. And as you say, a young player who has only a few hundred at-bats, especially against left-handed pitching, because it's so relatively infrequent to see. So maybe a guy has 100, 150 at-bats, and the temptation is to look at that and say, oh, look, he's hitting 420 or 319 or something against left-handed pitching. Therefore, I can trust him in this particular encounter against a left-handed pitcher tonight when I'm picking my daily fantasy team, and maybe I'll get an edge because he's a left-handed hitter himself, or blah blah blah. You know, I'm playing against the grain, but really the error bar is very wide. And then as the guy moves towards that 3,000 plate appearance threshold, the error bar maybe gets smaller until you get to the point where it's actually trustworthy.
Right. I think if you think of it in terms of a weighted average. In that, you know, you said 400. So after 200 plate appearances, he's hitting 400, and you need around 1,000 to 1,200 versus lefties for you to own your split. So now you take, you know, 400 at hitting 400 at 200 plate appearances, and then hitting the league average for the other 1,000, and do a weighted average to get the regression. So he's not going to be at the league average. It's going to be pulled a little bit better than the league average. That's what the regression's all about. But it's still not to the 400 extent that you may have thought it was. And in, you know, if you're looking for that edge in daily, you might overestimate the player's potential that particular evening based upon a split that may exist, but he said he needs to. I mean, if he's at 1,000 plate appearances and you only need 1,200, you know, it's not going to change that much in 200 more. So that's why you use the weighted average. But, you know, a lot of these young kids that come up, I think it's one of the things with numbers. You need to use numbers, but sometimes I think we try to get too smart with them and use them sort of without actually knowing where the derivation or where they come from. And by trying to be smart, sometimes you try to do yourself too much harm by being smart using the numbers.
Well, especially if you're misinterpreting them or using them incorrectly. And when I was reading the column and thinking about it for my own purposes, I thought, in general, there are enough established players on the hitter lists in the daily fantasy games that you shouldn't really need to find a left-handed hitter who has a decent batting average or performance statistics against left-handed pitching. There's lots of right-handed hitters who have just the general benefit of being crossing a left-handed pitcher. I don't really understand why anybody would want to find a left-handed hitter unless the idea was he's a good left-handed hitter anyway. Maybe they get into the bullpen and so forth. And in general, I want in tournament play not to have the same roster as everybody else.
I don't think I'll ever take... I don't care if it's Anthony Rizzo or one of the better left-handed hitters in the league. I won't have my left-handed hitter go up against a left-handed starter. And even if it's a lousy left-handed starter, it's just, they're, like you mentioned, there are just too many other strong matchups out there. So I don't have to, you know, I'm not going to bench Anthony Rizzo in my traditional fantasy, but I'm not going to go overboard. Even as hot as Bryce Harper's been playing, I'm not going to play him against a lefty just because another reason being, if you're going against a salary, his salary is judged in his performance. And if you partition the performance into versus lefties and versus righties, bang for the buck wise, when he's facing a lefty, the return on investment isn't as much because, you know, the salary incorporates the numbers versus righties.
Right.
So from that basis alone, I think you lose a little bit as, you know, and at least in the DFS going against salaries. And that kind of brings up sort of another side point in that handedness, you know, it tilts you in a particular direction. It doesn't take a bad left-handed batter against a right-handed pitcher and make him better than Miguel Cabrera against a right-handed pitcher. You know,
right.
You still have to have a baseline, and how much over that baseline the player gets and readjust. It doesn't miss, you know, there still might be a righty on righty matchup out there. I don't avoid those. Because like you mentioned before, those happen so frequently that I think right-handers aren't as penalized facing right-handed pitchers as lefties are facing lefties.
The flip side of this seems to me, again, when I was just thinking about this after I read it, is that there might be a play that you might be tempted to take a lesser skilled or a lesser reputation left-handed pitcher if you knew he was going up against a lineup made up predominantly or even more than half of left-handed hitters or with significant left-handed hitting presence there, because the strikeout rate for left-handed hitters goes up against left-handed pitchers in a way that was one of the most stark examples of handedness difference.
And this week's a perfect example to talk about that. The Colorado Rockies, actually, it's going to be four in a row because they're facing Kershaw, have faced three left-handers this week. I know one was Hector Santiago. I know it was Brett Anderson. It was C.J. Wilson was the first pitcher. And in DFS, in Colorado striking 30% out, striking out 30% of the time against left-handers on the road. And I used a pitcher each time, and each time it paid off. So there's definitely something to that. Who's going to use Hector Santiago? Who's going to use Brett Anderson? Well, because they were facing Colorado, and Colorado, for whatever reason, just strikes out a ton versus left-handers, it did pay off. And tonight they're going against Clayton Kershaw, so look out.
Yeah, and the strikeouts help, and of course the likelihood of him winning and not giving up too many hits and so forth. I think that may be where the advantage is real. But from the pitcher's point of view, how long does it take for the sample size to settle out? You mentioned 3,000 plate appearances for hitters. How many batters faced or innings pitched does a pitcher need to own those splits?
I don't have the number off the top of my head. It's the next study I'm going to do. The answer is not nearly as many. I don't have the exact number. I'm horrible about remembering things, which is why I was really glad the internet was invented.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
Because then I didn't have to remember things. It was always there for me. But the short answer is a pitcher owns his splits much faster than a hitter. So if you do see pitchers out there with reverse splits, a right-hander that's able to get out left-handers, better than the norm, those splits are considered real. And my homework assignment for this week is to get that answer for you next week.
Okay.
Cause I do think it is fairly important. And, so at least this week we'll leave it as pitchers own their splits faster than hitters.
You're listening to Baseball HQ Radio, Patrick Davitt with Todd Zola, our regular weekly talk with Todd. And Todd, also at Fantasy Alarm, after last week's look at hitters who are improving their strikeout rates, this week you have hitters whose strikeout rates are getting worse, and you're talking about this year versus the average of the previous three. What was the story there?
Right. This is a continuation of my my pet little process of the sample is not too small to start making determinations at this point of the season as far as buy high, sell low, and what you might expect for a player, in that the contact rate or the strikeout rate, the 60 plate appearances is the mark where you can begin to raise the expectations or lower the expectations of the player, in that it's been shown that 50% of players that are striking out more or less than they were for their career at this point, after the 60 plate appearance mark, are expected to continue to strike out more or less than that particular mark. You're raising the baseline, the over-under mark, if you will. And so last week we mentioned guys that are, I feel, are going to be having a better year than they did last year, at least as far as contact rate goes. And this week we looked at those that are striking out more than, I call it expectations, and I'm just using the three-year average because I think we know the, at least as far, you know, a baseline for expectation, it's been shown in the three-year average. Excuse me, it's pretty representative. So we just looked at the players that are to this point of the season, and we're actually a week later. So, you know, these guys have got more plate appearances. I reran the numbers from last week's, when I did last week. So these guys have even more plate appearances. So, kind of what we talked about with the splits, more appearances, plate appearances over 60, you're even more likely to stay upon the same course that you're at the time.
As you did last week, you have three tiers of players, the lowest being maybe a little bit concerned. These are players whose strikeout rates are 17 to 20% worse. Then you have a middle category where they're 23 to 27% worse or so, and that's percentage, not percentage points. And then at the top, you have batting average drains, which is a real cautionary title, I think. Brett Laurie's at the top. His strikeout rate has gotten 78% worse, which seems almost like it must be an outlier of some kind. But there are some pretty important players on this list of batting average drains. Give us a couple.
Two of them that kind of stuck out like a sore thumb to me right off the top were Edwin Encarnacion and Jose Bautista. Mainly they were two of the top five. They're on the same team. They hit next to each other in the order. They're both being counted upon not just for their home runs, but for their runs and RBIs. And if they're both, you know, losing some opportunities because they're both striking out a little bit more, then I think at the beginning of the year, we may have overestimated their runs and RBIs expectations a little bit, which I think in standard rotisserie, I think sometimes we might overlook that as far as, you know, where we're going to rank that player as far, you know, rankings, how many runs and RBIs they get. So those two names sort of in tandem kind of stuck themselves out. And they were near the top of the list. Now, and Encarnacion, you know, he's still striking out at, you know, 21%, which in this day and age isn't horrible. Bautista, again, he also went from 15 to 22%. So in a vacuum, they're not horrible, but they're just worse than what they've done before. And it's not to say they're going to have bad seasons. There are other, you know, statistics that contribute to an overall stat line. But, you know, if you're striking out more, and even if your power is better, you're not going to have as many, it's not going to manifest as many times because you are striking out a little bit more.
I was going to ask about the Eric Ibar, who's on the list. His strikeout rate this year is only 15%, and his 3-year rate is 10%, so he's actually 50% worse. But 15% strikeout rate is still really good. There's other guys on the list as well who have gone from the 10-ish area to the 15-ish area, and the percentage change looks pretty bad. But as in the greater scheme of things, a lot of these guys are still pretty good contact hitters.
Yeah, I'm beginning to wonder, instead of doing percent better or worse, if I should have subtracted the two and used as the measuring stick. You know, last year was 10, this year it's 20, so it's a 10% difference, because that is a better reflection of the number of plate appearances they're going to do better or worse in. I still think it's important to note that Ibar, his game is getting on base, it's running, that sort of thing. So even if it's just 5% more time striking out, that's a few less steals and a few less other opportunities. So I do think it's important, but by putting him in that top list might be overstating the importance. So if we were to subtract the 15.4 that he's striking out now and the 10.2 that he's done over 3 years, that being a 5% difference, he may have fallen into one of the lower lists. And yeah, you know, it's a concern, but it's not as if I'm going to dump Eric Ibar. So in retrospect, next time I do this, I may want to rethink the way that I present the data.
Yeah, going from a percentage difference to a percentage point difference might be a little more illuminatory, but at the same time, there's something to be said, as you mentioned, for looking at the percentage rate change, because that also is significant. It's a combination of the two. Now, in keeping with the theme of what we've been talking about so far, Todd, all of the players on this batting average drain list are in the sort of 135 to 150 plate appearance range. Is that enough of a sample for you to feel pretty confident?
Well, it's you know, the 660 is the minimum. So, yes, I feel confident that, the study says that half of these guys are going to continue to strike out more times than they have in the past. Now, because we're past 60, I think at this point, a few more than half, in theory, should. So, eyeballing, 16 or 18 names, so maybe 10 of these names will continue on, and maybe 6 of these won't, and maybe two of them may be Encarnacion and Bautista, I don't know. But what we do is we manage probabilities, and the probability is that, these guys in a vacuum, you can take each individual one, the probability is, take another name, Robinson Cano will continue to strike out a little bit more than he's been striking out in the past. And if Robinson Cano's not hitting for power, which he's not doing, you need every single, hit that he gets from that three-hole to drive in some runs and to score himself. So, it's a little, to me, it's significant. He's kind of like Ibar. The percentage difference pretty huge. The raw difference isn't all that much, which is what you're going to get for players that aren't, don't have a huge strikeout rate to begin with. But, I think, yes, at this point, I think it's actionable. What the results from the study, I think it's actionable.
You do mention towards the end of the column that the small sample size did have an effect on Bryce Harper, whom you mentioned last week when you first ran the numbers. You point out that Harper was actually way up there in the Encarnacion Bautista bunch with a 32% decline. A week later, because you recalculated, Bryce Harper had a terrific week. His decline sank from 32% to just 20%, and now you say that, looking at the entire picture, you're still a little concerned about Harper, and there are some moves that you would make, including selling high.
Right, and I didn't want to hide behind the fact that, I think if I hadn't said that, if I just printed this list, the real easy thing would have been to do is say, yeah, Bryce Harper shows up, but don't worry about it. He's great. He's hitting home runs. To me, that's not what this process says. The process says, I don't care how well he's doing, as far as power and the other elements of his game, he's striking out more. Now, the bias in there is gonna say that, he's more confident, he's swinging more, this thing, whatever. Once you start introducing a narrative to a number study like this, you're gonna have your own bias as far as, rationalizing away the data. If I'm gonna believe in the process tells me that once Harper slows down, and he will, because he's not going to hit 82 home runs. Once he slows down and hits a mini slump, it's going to be a little bit more severe of a slump than other people might think, because he's striking out more. So I'm not saying that I would trade Bryce Harper, for just anybody. I would need to get a heck of a player back if I owned Bryce Harper. But what I am saying is, I'm willing to bet that the large majority of people out there have a higher expectation going forward for Harper than I do. And that's sort of the litmus test for a trade. The person I'm dealing with has a higher expectation for Harper than I do. He might be willing to give me more, to get him because his expectation is that much higher. A player that I might like more than the other person might be Anthony Rizzo. Because of this study, he's striking out fewer times. Put my stick in the ground and say, this is what the study means to me. I can't do it because I don't own Bryce Harper. But if I did, I would accept a trade of Anthony Rizzo for Bryce Harper. I would give you my Anthony Rizzo for my Bryce Harper for your Anthony Rizzo right now, on the heels of this study. And I'm not so sure that everybody else would do that.
And the beauty of it is, if you could swing that trade, you might be able to ask for a little more because of the expectation of Bryce Harper versus the relatively lesser-known expectation of Anthony Rizzo. But that brings me to a question about Anthony Rizzo, and maybe to a lesser extent Harper as well, or maybe to the same extent, and that is, We talked about whether 120 plate appearances or whatever it is this year is a significant enough number to make decisions on. You say it is, but how confident can we be of the previous years, considering how few of them there are?
Yeah, I wrote about that too. That's sort of the elephant in the room. Is what if the expectation isn't right, and therefore the percentage different isn't right. The study I'm basing this on didn't delineate. So, you know, to me, a great follow-up study would be to sort of, is there a way to figure out which half we're going to be doing better or worse than the 60 plate appearances says? And, you know, I'm going to be tracking going forward. I now have my first list. So I'm going to run this study again in a month or 6 weeks or whenever I can't think of anything else to write about for this column and compare the list and how many names are on it that were on it before and how many names were on it that weren't on it previously and see if there's a certain characteristic, amongst the players that remain, and see if there's a characteristic amongst the players that leave. This, you know, it's 1 year. I mean, to really do this, I sort of have to sit down in the off season and just backtrack and get data after a month every season and sort of run it and see what I can figure out to see if there are some consistencies. But it, to me, it's a cute little exercise to run because I do have the first set of names and 30 of them on each piece. So it's a goodly number of names to continue to track. I suspect that, you know, that there is something to that because we don't know the baseline. And, you know, the obvious comparison for Harper is this time last year, no one really cared that Mike Trout was striking out more. And, you know, he still went on and had a fantastic season, both fantasy and otherwise. But, you know, all I'll say to that is, you know, it could have been better.
Right.
And that's all I'm saying is as good as we think Bryce Harper is going to be this year, it could even be better if he's the one in the other 50% that improves the strikeout rate, it's going to get better. But I don't know that. So, you know, looking for every edge I can get, I'm willing to rely on the process. And, like I said, if I happen to own Bryce Harper in a league, I would be willing to sell high on him. But I do play DFS and I do have the opportunity to have him on my team every night. And what I might do is not put him in my team because figuring someone else is going to like him, especially once he slows down a bit. People are still going to be using him and I won't be using him in part because of this study.
To wrap up on the study, we talked earlier about how your Eric Ibars and guys like that show big changes in percentage terms because of the baselines are so low. So a 10 to 15%, a movement from 10% strikeout rate to 15 becomes a 50% change, which seems really terrible, but he's actually only changing 5 points and it's only 15% when you finish at it. Compared with a guy who's in the little bit concerned list, Giancarlo Stanton, whose percentage change was at 17.4%, which doesn't seem nearly as bad, but he's going from a 28% rate all the way up to almost 33%, and that seems to put him into a very dangerous category where he's striking out more than a third of the time, and therefore it seems like, in the great scheme of things, Stanton is a worse situation than maybe an Ibar is or somebody else who has a bigger percentage change but a smaller percentage point change.
Right. The exact opposite effect has to occur in that, you know, right, if the difference is just a raw 5%, when you divide 5 by 15 and 5 by 30, the percentage is going to be hugely different. And that you know, there could be a raw percentage change of 10 or 15 that might get masked if the baseline is so high. So that, you know, in effect, that puts, it should anyway, take Giancarlo Stanton from maybe a little concerned into a much higher, level. Now, you know, as I mentioned in the article, you know, someone out there is, you know, even right now saying I'm a goofball for even thinking about trading Bryce Harper. You know, whereas if I were to make that argument about Stanton, who's hitting, you know, he's doing okay, but he's not doing otherworldly at this point. I don't, you know, people would, you know, suddenly maybe nod their head in agreement if I'm out, you know, yeah, that is the reason I need to trade Stanton because he's not off on a tear. The whole bias, I went through this several years ago when Jay Bruce was everybody's buddy and he was striking out more and he continued to strike out more. It was, you know, a lot of people out there thought I was nuts for recommending this about Jay Bruce. And when there were other players out there that, had a similar profile that weren't on the, you know, Bruce is always going to get hot. He gets hot every year. He's going to get hot again. Other players that didn't have that narrative that I talked about, I didn't take as much heat for. So I don't know that I'd take as much heat right now if I were to go out and say to tell, you know, trade Giancarlo Stanton. But yeah, he is one that at this point I am concerned about just because of the baseline where it is to begin with and where it is now. That is a pretty big, he can't afford to strike out anymore if he's not hitting, 40 home runs, he can't afford to strike out anymore.
And finally, Todd, since we're talking about strikeouts so much, I wonder what you thought of the Michael Pineda throws a 16-strikeout game and everybody's agog, and what happens a couple of days later, Corey Kluber goes out and throws an 18-strikeout performance. What do you make of what seem like outlier performances of this sort, and what do they say about Michael Pineda, Corey Kluber, or anybody else who has, especially a pitcher, who has such an unusually effective game?
Actually, it's sort of it's because it's similar. It's around the same time of year. During Kluber's game, I was thinking back to when I was in, actually, was undergrad at the time, when Roger Clemens had his 20 strikeout game. I was in Cleveland, and it wasn't quite the same where you could follow things over the internet. I had people calling me from home, telling me what's going on, and that sort of thing. It just kind of reminded me of that. But anyway, Kluber, it just serves to remind us about, you know, don't worry about the surface stats. Focus on the underlying peripherals. And Kluber's peripherals were fine. His strikeout rate and his walk rate were fine. He was getting burned by a terrible BABIP. Now, I do come from the mind that when you have a high BABIP, I don't think it's complete bit luck. I think there's some bad pitching in there as well. But or maybe not being quite as sharp, his strikeouts were just fine. In my daily notes, that column, that's pretty much what I wrote, was, you know, I didn't predict 18 strikeouts, and quite frankly, I think he should have been given the opportunity to go out there, and if he didn't strike out the first guy, you know, maybe lift him at that point. He deserved an opportunity to continue on. I didn't think it was that many pitches thrown, but on the other hand, you know, I'm not paying the money for Corey Kluber as far as real life. Pineda, I think it just shows us how good he actually is at this point, that he is now an elite pitcher in the, not just the American League, but overall. I was actually asked on a radio show this week if I would prefer Pineda or Strasburg for the rest of the season. And even though I had the caveat of, well, Strasburg's shoulder, I'm going with Pineda, you know, I kind of said if Strasburg was healthy, I'm actually thinking at this point that I think Pineda and Strasburg are on a par. I think you consider them, you know, similar pitchers at this point. I wouldn't mind if, you know, Pineda the rest of the season. As far as, you know, an individual, you know, game itself, you know, the dailies taught me that, you know, you can look at team tendencies. We talked a little bit before about Colorado. The Kansas City Royals don't strike out. Michael Pineda is going tonight against the Kansas City Royals. I don't expect one of those huge strikeout games from Pineda this evening. And I think, you know, similar to how if 60 plate appearances is enough for an individual player to use contact rate, I certainly think we can talk about a team at this point. If a team's striking out at a really low rate, I think we consider that to be real. So if I'm playing daily tonight, you know, we're doing the tout daily tonight, Michael Pineda is not going to be my pitcher because I don't think he's going to get the raw number of strikeouts against the Kansas City Royals that someone else like Madison Bumgarner might get or Clayton Kershaw might get against another team tonight.
Ron Chandler is now writing for ESPN's Fantasy on the Insider area, so you have to pay for it, but it could be worth it. It really is. It's a lot of terrific blogs in there. He wrote about Corey Kluber just before the 18-strikeout performance, and he pointed out there are a lot of positive signs all along for Corey Kluber. As you said, the skills were not as disastrous, but he made an interesting point, I thought, which is he said that, considering the bad outings that Kluber put up at the start of the year, it's going to take about two superb outings to offset every one bad one. And then he asks rhetorically, how likely is that to happen so that by the end of the year, that you can say, I got a Corey Kluber season out of my third round pick, Corey Kluber.
At this, it's, I mean, what's done is done, though. I mean, what you can't control, even if it was bad luck, you can't control it. All you can do is make sure you fully benefit from what going forward. Now, it kind of caught me a little bit by surprise. In the NFBC, 5% of his owners bench Kluber this week. And to me, that's silly, just because he, even if he doesn't have the season-ending stats that you quite expected, this goes back to the whole thing, I'm going to put a guy on the bench until he has a couple good outings. Well, you're going to have, you have a certain expectation for the entire year. If you have one or two of the better outings on your bench, what goes into your actual stats aren't nearly what you expected anymore. So, while I think Ron's point may have been just to show how extreme the early performance was, I don't know that we're necessarily expecting Kluber to equal what he did last season. Heck, he won the Cy Young last season. But I do think that going forward, we can expect a Corey Kluber, one of the top pitchers in the league again, and, fleshing the luck out of the equation. I don't think anybody expected what he did last year anyway. So, how many more good outings will it take to get him to what we reasonably expected this year? I think he could still do that. I don't know that, I didn't expect a repeat of last year, and I assume you didn't quite either.
No.
But you expected a pretty good pitcher.
Yeah, I did, and I think that's how he got bid in the drafts that I was in. A cautious expectation of a good pitcher, but probably not a Cy Young, because it was such an outlier season. Chandler, in his ESPN column, pointed out after making this notation about that Kluber's going to need 14 superb performances to offset his 7 bad ones so far, he went on and looked and said, how likely is Corey Kluber to have 14 good superb performances and the rest okay to drag his numbers back down to where you'd like them to be by the end of the year? He says he's going to pitch 26 or 27 more times this season, which means he's going to have to pitch very, very well in at least half. And he did that last year. In 27 starts last year, in his last 27, Chandler reports, Kluber pitched very, very well 20 times, reasonably well 3 times, but suffered 4 more blowouts as well. So he could balance the damage he's done or not. But I think your point is really critical, is if you intend, you're kind of stuck in a Hobson's choice. You could trade him, which locks in his bad performance for the year, and you're never going to get the benefit of anything he does well. Or you could keep him and hope that he does well, and if he doesn't, you're doubly screwed.
Right. I mean, we talked about this a little bit with a guy like Drew Hutchinson. I can see benching him, although we don't want to think about what the draft day cost was. We want to manage our team based upon what we expect. But a lot of, we paid a little bit for Drew Hutchinson. I want to get my money's worth out of him. So he's going to be active. Whereas, some of these pitchers that we didn't pay a whole lot for, I can see putting them on your bench until they have a good start or two, because the expectations weren't as high. But, I know 5% is not a whole lot, but it just kind of, I did have to kind of scratch my head. And there's different reasons why people, who knows, a loaded pitching staff, and maybe they actually did have a better, a 2-start pitcher better than Corey Kluber this particular week. But, it's just, to me, I have Kluber. He's in my lineup till death do us part.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'm not going to play matchups with the ace of my staff. I don't think it's a sensible way to approach how you do it. I think St. Louis Cardinals coming up next for Kluber. And, yeah, they're a good team. They don't strike out as much as some others. It's a tough matchup for Corey Kluber. You still have to have him out there. I mean, it's a sunk cost, as you said.
Well, the thing with the Cardinals, too, and, again, this is stems from DFS analysis, they're winning by pitching. I mean, they score runs, but they're not going to label just to lay one on Corey Kluber, and anything could happen. But might he not get the win? Well, it depends on who he's going up against and how his bats do. But he should do his job and keep his team in the game. And in seasonal roto, that's kind of what you want. That's the difference between seasonal and DFS. Sometimes when we go to rank pitchers, seasonal rotos, strikeouts are very, very important, but run prevention and hit prevention is just as important. Where in the DFS, it's all about innings and it's all about Ks, with run prevention being secondary.
One other advantage Chandler notes about the Cardinals matchup, they haven't seen him ever. This is going to be the first time for most of the hitters in the Cardinals lineup, which I think the general belief, I've never seen research to the effect, but the general belief is if hitters haven't seen a pitcher, the pitcher has the edge from that unfamiliarity.
Right, and you know, that's why here in spring training, why is Clayton Kershaw throwing in the B game today? Well, that's because the A game was against the Padres or San Francisco, I don't want to necessarily Kershaw, because everybody's seen Kershaw, but maybe a younger pitcher, and they don't want to, you know, even in spring training, you're seeing the guy. You know, why is Carlos Frias throwing in the B game? Well, it's because they don't want, you know, every edge we can get is good. So, you know, the fewer times they see him in the spring, you know, let them get their experience when it counts during the regular season.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself. We'll go out on that note. Todd Zola, thanks very much for joining us again this week. We'll talk to you again next Friday.
Absolutely. Have a good week, Patrick.
You bet. Thanks again, Todd. Todd Zola writes for BaseballHQ.com, ChandlerPark.com, ESPN, FantasyAlarm, MastersBall.com. And, of course, he's here at Baseball HQ Radio every Friday. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Wherever Todd Zola is writing or talking, you should be reading or listening. When we come back, it's our regular Friday commentaries, pitcher matchups, and master notes next on Baseball HQ Radio.
First off, Stengel was, to me, one of the more misunderstood figures in baseball because of his time with the Mets and because he understood what his role was, and his role was to entertain the media. And I think his baseball knowledge and his general acumen was really lost in a lot of that caricature. You okay? He became a caricature of himself. And for the players, though, it was interesting. You know, he'd get you in spring training every year, and he'd had the same routine. I mean, with the Mets, I mean, he really started with the basics. I mean, you know, like he went over to the bag, and he reached in there, and he pulled out a ball, and he said, "This is a baseball." That's where we started.
Baseball HQ Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Baseball HQ Radio. I'm Patrick Davitt. Now it's time for our regular Friday commentaries. Coming up, we'll have Ray Murphy in Master Notes. And now it's our pitcher matchup report. BaseballHQ.com has developed algorithms to determine the strength or weakness of every starting pitcher matchup based on opponent, park, and other factors. Pitchers score from -5 to +5. We recommend pitchers with matchup ratings of +2 or higher, while we suggest you avoid pitchers with matchup ratings below 0. In between, it's a risk-reward situation, and here with some of this weekend's matchups focusing on those risk-reward situations is BaseballHQ.com analyst Greg Fishwick.
Each league has a Saturday game in which both starting pitchers' matchup ratings fall into the risk-reward category. So let's focus on those. In the American League, Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim right-hander Matt Shoemaker takes his matchup rating of 150 into Baltimore's Camden Yards. Camden Yards enhances left-handed batters' home runs by 33%, highest in the American League. The O's also offer a right-handed pitcher in Bud Norris, with his matchup rating of 050. In January, BaseballHQ.com facts and flukes analyst Dave Adler noted Norris's declining swinging strike rate, which had dropped from 11% in 2012 to 8% in 2014. And he warned us that it would not be surprising to see Norris take a step back in 2015. After six starts, Norris's swinging strike rate is still at 8%. This season, Norris has been plagued by the dreaded double whammy of a high hit rate at 37%, including an incredible left-handed batter's hit rate of 49%, and a low strand rate at 45%. But in his 27 innings pitched, he's walked 13 and struck out 18. Through 2012, Norris's dominance rate, also known as strikeouts per 9 innings pitched, averaged 8.8. It is now 5.9. It's not worth the risk to expect a change of luck for Norris to help him enough this Saturday in Baltimore. Matt Shoemaker has a better chance to reward your risk. In his brief career of 172 major league innings pitched, Shoemaker has held left-handed batters to an on-base percentage of 299 and a slugging percentage of 441. His secret is a split-finger fastball, which helps him achieve a dominance rate over 8. In 2014, he had a ground ball rate of 41% and a fly ball rate of 39%. But therein lies the risk. In the small sample of 31 innings so far this year, his fly ball rate is up to 49%. And he's given up 10 home runs for a home run per fly ball rate of 22%. But Shoemaker is worth the risk because his 31 strikeouts in those 31 innings hint that the fly balls and the home runs per fly ball are early season aberrations. In the National League, lefty Alex Wood leads the Atlanta Braves into Marlins Park in Miami to face right-hander Matt Latos. Only AT&T Park makes home runs a tougher task for hitters. Marlins Park depresses home runs for left-handed batters by 38% and right-handed batters by 22%. Wood has the higher matchup rating at 108 and was the subject of a BaseballHQ.com Facts and Flukes feature by analyst Greg Piron just last week. Piron pointed out that Wood's swinging strike rate of 5% was only half of his previous 10% baseline, and that Wood had been quoted as saying he needed to make some adjustments to both his sinker and his changeup after a PQS disaster zero start on May 4. He bounced back on May 10 with a fine PQS 4 performance and appears to be riding the ship. Previously, Wood has handled right-handed batters and left-handed batters with equal aplomb, but right-handed batters have enjoyed a 40% hit rate against him in the early going of 2015. Expect that number to normalize too, making Wood a good risk for the reward of improved performance. And where is the love for Latos? His past five starts have produced PQSs of 3, 4, 3, 4, and 5, and his matchup rating is only 0-13? Before you think 13 could be a lucky number if you're willing to risk starting Latos, let's look a little deeper. His average fastball velocity was 92.6 miles per hour in 2012 and in 2013. After off-season elbow surgery, it's now 2 miles per hour lower at 90.6. His first two starts were PQS zeros in which he allowed a combined 9 earned runs in less than 5 innings pitched, during which he walked 5 and struck out 5. But in the 30 innings since then, he has walked only 9 and struck out 23, producing an ERA of 2.70. And despite his early 2015 hard-hit ball rate being a career-high 38%, he's still allowed only 2 home runs. He might be the longest shot of the weekend, but I like Latos to return some value for the risk. So your risks worth taking this weekend are Shoemaker, Wood, and even Latos, but not Norris. Next weekend, we'll check our record over the first 6 weeks of the season and examine some more weekend matchups. For Baseball HQ Radio, this is Greg Fishwick of BaseballHQ.com.
Greg Fishwick is a pitcher matchups analyst at BaseballHQ.com and here at Baseball HQ Radio. Now it's time for Master Notes, a weekly commentary on baseball and fantasy baseball. With a look at catching casualties, here's BaseballHQ.com co-general manager and speculator columnist Ray Murphy.
The first several weeks of 2015 have not been kind to the catcher pool. Jonathan Lucroy, Yan Gomes, and Devin Mesoraco have all been just about useless so far this year due to injuries. Based on Baseball HQ preseason projections, that trio was supposed to be the number 2, number 3, and number 4 ranked catchers in terms of mixed league roto value this year. That projected value has gone kaput, at least so far. The carnage runs deeper than the top tier. Breakout candidate Travis d'Arnaud is out until midseason. John Jaso stopped catching in an attempt to stay in the lineup, but even DH work couldn't keep him from the DL. The Red Sox lost their top two catchers, first Christian Vasquez and then Ryan Hannigan. We haven't even seen Matt Wieters in Baltimore yet, even though he was supposed to be just slightly delayed in his return from Tommy John surgery. There are non-injury situations, too. Jared Saltalamacchia got flat-out waived by the Marlins and hasn't surfaced in Arizona yet. And the Rockies essentially gave up on Willian Rosario catching at all. All of this attrition came from a pocket of the player pool that didn't have any slack in the first place. When I wrote my annual straight draft guide back in March, one of my observations was that the back end of the catching pool, at least in two-catcher mixed leagues, was particularly hideous, even more so than usual. So how do you manage your roster around this mess? I'm not sure I have any good answers, but I thought I would share my experiences. I have Mesoraco in several leagues, but let's focus on two. Labor Mixed and my NFBC Main Event Squad. In the former case, my opening day catchers were actually Mesoraco and Salto Amakia. A couple of weeks ago, as I tried to patch my way around that situation, I spent a week with five catchers on my active roster. Well, two active and three more on reserves. That's not something I've ever done before, nor is it something I can even pretend to defend as a best practice. But given the context, I think how I got there is actually defensible. I added AJ Pierzynski when Mesoraco first got shelved, and then I added Wellington Castillo when Salto Amakia got released. Those were straightforward moves. There was an opportunity cost to clogging those two bench spots, as neither of my starters could be DL'd. But since Labor Mixed has unlimited DL spots plus six reserve spots, tying up two of those six spots on extra catchers wasn't all that stifling. Of course, I wasn't done. The next week, I bid on and won new call-up Blake Swihart. Because I had a pitcher go on the DL that week, I didn't need to drop anyone to add Swihart. And since the league has a rule that any player picked up needs to go into the active lineup right away, there wasn't anyone in the free agent pool that I wanted to pick up and start that week. So I carried the five catchers for a week. We're still at four catchers there now. But Mesoraco spends next week in AL Parks, and Arizona could be a boon to Salto Amakia's outlook, based on park factors alone. So I'm glad I still have those two, and I'm looking forward to cutting AJ Pierzynski soon. If Mesoraco and Salto Amakia both come back, I'll have some trading options. Over on my NFBC roster, the situation is rather different. That league does not have unlimited DL spots. There's a seven-man reserve list without a separate DL. And we are already carrying a few injured guys. Anthony Rendon, Masahiro Tanaka, Jose Reyes. Here, our second catcher paired with Mesoraco is Rene Rivera, who has been less than productive. So we set out to find another catcher here as well, figuring that we would cut Mesoraco if his situation didn't resolve soon, or if Mesoraco does get back behind the plate, we could just cut Rivera. Once Alex Avila got injured and James McCann got the resulting playing time bump in Detroit, we added McCann as that replacement catcher. To add a third catcher to that already tight roster, we had to put the injured Reyes back into our active lineup this week. Of course, if we hadn't added McCann, we would have still been starting Mesoraco, which is almost the same thing as taking an empty roster spot. These nebulous injury situations are just the worst. If Mesoraco were declared out for the year, that would be a blow, but at least one I could start working to recover from. Instead, waiting for a resolution for over a month now is kind of a purgatory. Mesoraco said this week that he thinks his hip is getting better, and that he's acquired an outfielder's glove as another potential path to get back into the lineup this year. So, it looks like I'll be spending some more time in this purgatory. For Baseball HQ Radio, this is Ray Murphy of BaseballHQ.com.
Ray Murphy is BaseballHQ.com co-general manager and speculator columnist, and he's a member of the Masternotes rotation here at Baseball HQ Radio. You can get Masternotes delivered to your email inbox every Friday in the weekly free Fantasy Friday e-newsletter. Just go to BaseballHQ.com and sign up. Of course, we also have Masternotes here at Baseball HQ Radio every week. And that's Baseball HQ Radio for Friday, May the 15th. Thanks very much for taking the time to download and listen to show number 26 of the 2015 fantasy baseball season. I also want to thank our regular guest for the Friday News and Notes edition of Baseball HQ Radio. Todd Zola is always a great pleasure to talk with, and I learn a lot every time he comes on the show. I also want to thank our other contributors from BaseballHQ.com, the best fantasy baseball website in the business. Our Market Watch commentators were Harold Nichols and Jock Thompson. Our pitcher matchups analyst was Greg Fishwick. And our Masternotes commentator was BaseballHQ.com co-GM and speculator columnist Ray Murphy. I'm Patrick Davitt. I hope to see you on the BaseballHQ.com subscriber forums. Remember, you can stay in contact with Baseball HQ on Facebook and on our Twitter feed at Baseball HQ. You can also subscribe to my personal Twitter feed at Patrick Davitt and be the first to know when a new show is ready for download. More importantly, please tell your friends about Baseball HQ Radio and take a second to go to iTunes and add to our 4.8 star rating. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back again Tuesday when our special expert guest will be the author of the Joe Sheehan Baseball Newsletter. It's Joe Sheehan on the next edition of the podcast with Fantasy Baseball Intelligence for Winners. It is Baseball HQ Radio. So long.
Baseball HQ Radio is a weekly free podcast available through iTunes and other podcast aggregators, or directly from baseballhq.com, where we have an archive of past shows as well. Just look for the HQ Radio microphone logo on the right side of the baseballhq.com homepage. Baseball HQ Radio is a production of the USA Today Sports Media Group. The opinions expressed on Baseball HQ Radio are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of the USA Today Sports Media Group. The program is produced and edited by Patrick Davitt.